The world-famous Conservation Canine Camp will next be running in southeast Queensland, Australia, from the 21st to the 25th of August. Join us with your dog to start your journey into conservation detection. Visit padfoot.com.au to book your place today. Welcome to the Conservation Canine Podcast, the show that celebrates the dog teams protecting the natural world. I'm James Davis, and in this episode, I'm joined by Wesley Fisher from Scent Imprint Conservation Dogs in the Netherlands. We talk about the challenges of training teams for wildlife crime, ecological monitoring, and invasive control all around the world. Wesley Fisher, Scent Imprint Conservation Dogs. Thank you for coming on the Conservation Canine Podcast.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for your invitation. It's an honor.
Oh, delighted to have you here. So first things first, can you please tell us who you are and how you got into the world of kind of working dogs and then conservation dogs?
Yeah, of course. Now I work with operational explosive and narcotics dogs in operational settings around 15 years. Starting my career as an explosive and narcotic dog handler, work at the airport, work at the seaport. Then I start working at football stadiums. I work in every operational environment, building there some experience up. And the last couple of years, People ask me more about, Wesley, can you train dogs to detect ivory? Wesley, can you detect dogs that detect like primates? And then the conservation work started.
That's awesome. So you got, I mean, you and your team, your organization, you work kind of all around the world. How did that come about? Because often with a lot of the conservation dog teams around the world, they work in their own backyards, if you see what I mean. They only work within the home country, whereas you're evident around the world. So how has that really come about, and how have those opportunities come your way, do you think?
I think it started because I built my, I have a training facility in the Netherlands, so I provide a lot of working dogs around the world. People see me at seminars or conferences, and first I always think, hey, who's that young kid on the block? and then I start talking, and then I heard I am from Holland. And so I build up my international relationships around the world, and they see my dogs in actions. And I always say, you can say to people, I'm good, but if you provide a dog and it's traveling a lot of distance, come in a different culture, different climate, and he still sniff or search like a rock star. Yeah, that's the best words which you can speak. So I think that's, in my case, and my passion for really training the dogs, not building a business, because I still love training dogs. I become more manager, more business meetings, and everything what's around. And sometimes I say, listen, people, I plan myself now a couple of days off and I go in the field with my dogs. So yeah, that's who I am, like a canine operator. But yeah,
victim of your own success. It gets a little bit like that, doesn't it? Sometimes you end up just administering the business that you've built rather than actually being out there doing what you really love and why you got into it in the first place.
Yeah, you say it correct. That's like 100% true. But that's why I have a good, strong team around me. So really talented people. And they have the same passion as me. I can say sometimes I step back or I will do this. And I have another person that do this or this. So yeah, a strong team, you can do more. So that's the key, I think.
Absolutely. So let's talk about Scent Imprint Conservation Dogs then. Talk about the organization, and let's talk about some of the projects that you've been involved in around the world.
I start up first. I have like of course Centiprint for dogs, but then my conservation job starting more and more. I can say the last couple of years are doing more conservation things than the other business part. So I was lucky that I get some connections and some job opportunities to deliver some dogs for Africa, for Indonesia, for Malaysia. And that's like amazing opportunity. And for me as a trainer, I learn a lot because if you look at Holland, for example, and you need like an explosive dogs, for example, everybody wants a shepherd, a really strong shepherd. And I always was a guy that say, listen, I don't want a shepherd. I want a hunting dog because they have also something special. If I provide like a really strong shepherd to Indonesia and they come there in a kennel and they spring around in a kennel and bark, the people are afraid. They don't want to take the shepherd out. So, for example, Indonesian government, they buy 40 dogs, shepherds, without any training. They just buy it. They think it works. They're like machines. So for me, that was really interesting to see because those dogs works with talented people, with good handlers. But yeah, if you come to a different culture, and you need to look, oh, where's the dog are going to search in which environment and what skills that have the people, then you start looking at other breeds. And that is for me the most interesting thing. And also lucky enough that I can start like projects that I say, listen, it's not about how many dogs you buy, but it's about the team. The specialized team what we train, because that's more important than buy 40 dogs. And a lot of contracts go wrong because they only look at the dogs, but not at the training, for example.
Mm. Yep. And so on that note, then, what breeds do you prefer? What breeds do you prefer? And what breeds do different countries kind of get along best with?
It depends on the operational environment, for example. So if you ask me like, I need to search on the public area, I say, yeah, Cocker Spaniel, Springer Spaniel, they are like machines, soft in the mouth. They always do the job. Lovely dogs, lovely dogs. If you ask, we travel to Africa and we need to track down like poachers, and I need to have like a dog easy to handle, I look at the hounds. So I have now like two new Bavarian hounds. They are like rock stars on the track. Easy for rangers. If you give me 2 weeks handler course, everybody can track with them, for example. So it's really about the job. But the German Pointer, for example, yeah, also a lovely dog. But I've also done some water search that we search on a kayak or a boat with terriers, for example. Unbelievable. They search like the whole day on a drive where I cannot think about, because first they always say it's about ball drive. But if you look at the terrier on a specific animal, what they need to locate, yeah, it's unbelievable what you see then. He searched like the whole day with a completely different drive. Yeah, that was for me new when I start doing that kind of work.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it, that we get very obsessed with, you know, requiring dogs with strong ball drive or whatever, but actually the dog dictates what motivates the dog. And so long as you can harness and reward, you know, the drive that you need, it doesn't really matter whether you're using food, ball, tug, or just, I mean, I've got a dog that works just because he likes to work, and that's his reward. He just wants to keep going.
Yeah, that's maybe you can you have an answer on these questions, because I have like two dogs for conservation. They're starting in my puppy program, so I did everything training inside, outside. And when I'm training inside in the normal detection environment, they're like really hectic in the mind, so they're like crazy. And if you see at different wind circulation inside, inside, they're really terrible. So I was like, oh, they're not good detection dog. But then I started in conservation work outside with them. Unbelievable. They search the whole day. They only work for food, no ball drive, but they work the whole day. And that was for me interesting to see, hey, this dog is searching outside, is hunting. Indicate, just get a treat for the search. But yeah, I don't know if you see it more with conservation dogs, but for me, it was really interesting because they search really long with the same drive, but without the ball drive.
I think maybe, just thinking off the top of my head, you know, it's particularly with the hunting breeds and that sort of thing, you know, there's got to be an element of genetics, you know, playing a part there somewhere. You know, that if they've been genetically chosen to work well, you know, in outside conditions, then those are the conditions they work best in. And certainly, you know, when we're doing a lot of inside work, we can get very systematic, you know, in terms of how we plan our searches and our requirements for that. And that doesn't that doesn't sort of suit a lot of breeds. I mean, you know, I've got a Springer Spaniel now that wouldn't do well, you know, inside. He's just too high powered. He's just, yeah, he doesn't have the ability to do systematic search. Get him out in the field and he'll do 25, 30 kilometers in a day without quitting, you know, and I've got to pin him down to make him stop. So
that is what I mean. I think about the circulation and outside they can run, they can speed, work, like on more scent or like they release a lot of energy. I think that's that's interesting fact. Interesting fact.
And it does highlight the fact that you do need to, you know, to work the dog in front of you, you know, so, and this is very important, I think, particularly in the conservation dog world where there's lots of different breeds, arguably more breeds than used in other detection disciplines, you know, used in the conservation field. And they've all got their unique skills and preferences and looking at the project you've got and selecting the correct breed, as you're saying, using the terriers, you know, obviously much better on the front of a kayak than an enormous shepherd or something like that. You know, it's about selecting the right dog, you know, with the right attributes, you know, to get the best out of the dog for the project.
That's what I say, 100% true. And I like to work also with different breeds because they learn you different things. Mm. If you can train one shepherd, of course, a couple of shepherds are different, but on the same drive, the same energy. So different breeds learn you other things and especially different disciplines. So I always look at the project, what we need to do, and the working conditions. So that is for me really important but also interesting to keep in mind if we're starting a project.
Yeah. So before we start talking about the projects in detail, let's keep on the dog training side of things, you know, for a minute. So obviously you've got a program when are you just developing puppies or do you work with older rescue dogs as well?
To be honest, when I starting, like, almost 8 years ago, my own company, I only starting with puppies because I like to train and shape puppies. So when I hold a puppy and do them on the floor, they already search like 8 weeks for explosive narcotics and they indicate where it sits. And that's the only thing what they do. So I work on that. And then I was starting, company become more busy, traveling around the world more. So then I see, okay, now I have like my trainers, they have more time than me. I say, okay, listen, you hold this puppy. And this puppy, you train him. And to be honest, I say it now also here, they do it now much better because they have the time. Normal, I miss that time when I have just one puppy and train it like so many sessions, short sessions a day. I miss that time. Now I only have like the tracking dogs. I hold them by myself. So I have now two puppies and this time zone is good for me. So I do a lot of tracking exercise in the morning, afternoon, and in the weekend. I keep doing that. So, but sometimes now I have a project when they call me and say, listen, Wes, we need an explosive dogs in 3 months or 4 months. Yeah, I don't have maybe a dog that is ready to go out, or they're not psychology ready. So then I need to scout and select some green dogs. So I can scout a dog with ball drive. Of course, last two times I take a dog from a shelter. So if it's possible, I select and scout that type of dogs. But yeah, it depends on how many time I have. But especially my operational dogs, I like to shape as puppy because, yeah, you see different at a level.
Yeah. It's an interesting question, really. There's debates on either side of the argument. And I mean, obviously, you know, training a puppy, particularly the earlier you can get it, the imprinting is a lot, you know, is a lot smoother, and you can shape, you know, the behavior exactly as you want it from when they're really tiny. And so that it's sort of a smoother path, I guess, in some respects. But obviously going with a rescue dog, there's obviously the moral benefit of, you know, actually, you know, rescuing, you know, a dog, and you know, you see some fantastic dogs at a rescue, and but you still need to go out and assess them, grade them, you know, assess that ball drive and so on. So, I mean, ultimately, you know, from an operational perspective, you know, you, I, lots of other people in this industry, you know, we've got to get a dog ready for a job, you know, so you've got somebody coming to you saying, right, you know, there's this project, whether it's a conservation project or whatever. How do you go about really assessing, how do you compare, say, the drive in an 8-week-old puppy versus the way you'd be able to assess the drive in a 2-year-old, you know, rescue spaniel?
Yeah, so for me, if I'm scouting a puppy, and it's like, I think I train more than 50 puppies to operational level in all those years. So what for me is the best test, if I go to a Cocker Spaniels and they're from hunting line and I throw a little ball, they will go. They will retrieve it, no problem. Some shepherds, they like the tuck, for example, to bite, but not like retrieving it, for example. So, of course, I do this little exercises. But what for me is the most important exercise and test for a sniffer dog, and it's like really easy if you think about. So I do some sausage on my hand, and I make a spot on the ground. So I make a spot on the ground. Then I let the little puppies coming, and you see some puppies are playing or they go to people, and I make sure that I'm standing with two or three people around, and I see two puppies, boom. They got in contact with the scent and start sniffing, and they work it out, boom, to shorts. Then I lift up the puppy a little bit, and then I step like, 2 meters away and do them again on the floor. What you see then is some puppies, they look like, huh? Oh, I see a brother or sister playing. Oh, I will go there. But the puppies with search drive, they go immediately back to the spot or try to locate again. Mm. Of course, I make spots in a wider section. And what you see then, when the one spot is gone, is empty, some puppies are going to play, some puppies going to sleeping. And you see one, if you're lucky, two puppies that keeping searching. And I say this is for everyone that want to select a puppy, an amazing test. And those puppies will never let you down on sniffer work. Mm. It can be like a medical reason or maybe some environment that you want to work where they're not good. For example, you want that they search inside an airport, but they are not liking strange people, but they like to search outside. That is possible. But for search drive, they're always on 100%. So that's a really good exercise.
Yeah, I think that's great. I mean, you're really there tapping into that kind of inherent desire and ability. And if they're already defaulting to using their nose and they're sticking and they're, even after you've moved them away, they're driving back, you know, to the interesting thing, you know, the interesting odor, it's a good starting point.
Yeah, and we don't say you need to search. So it's the inside drive of searching for more. And that's a really good test for a sniffer dog.
So putting age aside, I mean, so how long would it take you normally to get a dog operationally ready?
Now, there's also an interesting fact. If you look at the hunting lines, the hunting breeds, smaller breeds like Cocker Spaniel, Springer Spaniel, unbelievable. So what I say, last time, sometimes when we have really a diamond, when they're 6 months old, I take them to the operational site just for training and to see what's happening. And I got a real find. And I was like, whoa, what's this? If you look at larger breeds, what you see, of course, they can recognize odor, they search, but in their mind, in their head, they are not strong enough. So for shepherds, it takes longer. And for tracking dogs as well, it's really breed depending as well. So what I see when the breed is larger, and they breed also to go on site, it takes longer for the mind to do, to be aged and ready.
Okay, so do you mean it takes longer for their mind to kind of put the job together, or is it more just their confidence about being in the environment and that sort of thing?
Just environment strong. So, for example, the dog can be really strong here in the Netherlands, but if I send them on the airplane and they have like a stress and they need to go in a country in quarantine, maybe there's something happening in the mind. So that is also for me something what I keep in mind, that the dog need to be mental real strong and mental grow up that he can survive the plane trip. And sometimes I have a dog that say he will not survive the plane trip, but he can work here in Holland, in Europe, but I bring him with a car, but he cannot make the trip.
Mm. Yeah, I see. Okay. One more question before we move away from the actual training side of things. So you guys train dog teams, obviously, in the conservation field anyway, for wildlife crime, ecological monitoring, invasive species. Yeah, so you cover a broad spectrum of uses. There's a lot of obsession in the world at the moment around kind of passive indication and shaping very, very tidy indications, the airport indication, as I think of it. How do you go about training? I mean, do you shape the same indication, regardless of the job, or do you have different indications for different types of projects or different dogs, or how do you work on the indication side of things?
That's a really good question, because people are not looking first thing the operational field, the breed, what they have in front of them. And people become, I call it the Facebook or the Instagram indication. They want a brilliant indication. Mm. But in real life, when you search the whole day in the swamp, in the water, you know, as me, you not get the Facebook or textbook indication. Mm. So what's for me is really important, I shape a behavior. So I look at the natural reflection of the dog when he gets in the odor. And for me, there are four steps of an indication. So the first step is when the dog gets the first contact with the scent, what you see is a whiplash, like boom, and head pop. You see, that's the first contact with the scent. Outside, it can be from far. So they need to locate. You can also hear it, like...
Yep.
And that's for me the most important one, because I found on that sniffing frequency more traffic or more real finds than a real indication. Step two, they locate it. And then I see what's the natural reflex from the dog. So some dogs will freeze completely. Some dogs will do a lot of pressure in the body. Some dogs will turn around. Some dogs will go sit by themselves. So step three is like the duration. I see, okay, what's going to happen? And some dogs will start barking or scratch. And I say, okay, by step four, I want a sit or a down or a freeze, for example. But all those four steps, I will click. Even a fully operational dogs, I will click sometimes, because if you, for example, we are working in Indonesia and the most hectic port I ever seen. If you stand at front, it's crazy. The dog gets, you see emotion. His whole body is like fully in odor. And you see he keeps surrounding a car, but not indicate on it. But you see his passion. Then I say, okay, this car, we need an investigation. Why he was not indicating? Yeah, he was indicating, but not like a sit or a Facebook indication. Is because normal we train on a small amount of scent, but this car was like full with illegal wildlife trade. Mm. So the dog is picking up odor there, picking up odor there. He cannot pinpoint it.
No. Yeah.
So you know what I mean?
Mm. Yeah.
So for me, is that as important that the handlers can see that type of behavior? And of course, I can shape a sit or a lay down. For me, it's really important that the dog have respect for the object, for the wildlife, for example, so they not will scratch. But yeah, everything has to do with that. And I look at the natural reflex from the dog, because I've seen also years ago, they do like negative reinforcement on a sit. And when you see when the handler was going on the stress, or they need to search a long time, a blank that there is no odor, you see they're going to sit indication like more quickly. But I've seen now also the same when people just indicate on the Kong, indicate on the Kong, indicate on the Kong. You see when the dog is searching and the handler's going under pressure, the dog thinks, oh, I will go in a sit, because you always want that I go in a sit. So I've seen that also a little bit like that. So for me, it's like the natural reflex really important. And then I shape a sit or a freeze or a focus.
Mm-hmm. Cool. And what would you say the main difference is? Because obviously in your position, you're training narcotics dogs, explosives dogs, conservation dogs. What are the differences in your approaches to those kind of different disciplines?
I think a lot of things are the same. The only thing what for me was really interesting to see that, especially with wildlife trafficking, because it's you work like on the natural instinct from the dog, it's easier. But sometimes in a real operational, for example, we train the dogs on searching for 10 specific targets endangered species where they need to locate it. But some countries, every time they try to smuggle something else. And it's always impossible for us to train on everything. So what I've seen then, and also the dogs, that they have the mindset like that, like, hey, we're searching and we sniff something wildlife, so not farm animals, but really animals that being smuggled and they're like in a box and stressed, that they give not like the train it indication, but they give like a specific indication. And normal, I always say, when a narcotic dog indicate on tobacco, for example, you don't want that. Mm. But in this type of job, it's really safe to animal. So, but I only seen it with wildlife contraband, that the dogs have the ability to see, hey, this is like another species, but I think the stress level from the animal that's been smuggled, they provide something, and that the dog thinks I will give the specific indication on that. They don't do it with on farm animals, for example, because they are being transported there a lot. So that's the only thing what I've seen, like that's an interesting to see. But it's a positive thing. You understand what I mean?
I do. And how do you get around the challenges of getting the training aids for that? Because obviously, yeah, particularly when you're looking at wildlife crime, you're looking for either live or sadly dead, quite endangered species often. So the practical challenges of getting samples and sent, to train on is arguably the biggest problem. So how do you manage that?
Yeah, for me, I'm really in a lucky position that I can go here to the government and they provide me with any type of samples that I need. But that in the first years, that was not also possible for me. But because of the project, what I do overseas, the Dutch embassy was also located there. So they make a special letter for me. But I say also honest, it also depends on the breed, for example. Because, if you look at the hunting dogs again, the first time I travel, the first dogs I train for weapons and ammunition. The dogs will go to Mali to search for ivory and weapons ammunition. That was the job. So I say, I don't have ivory, but I can train them on weapons, ammunition. When I travel to there, it takes me a couple of days to train, and they will indicate on again. Now, the first time, there were like 3 Cocker Spaniels. The first time when I, a really natural ivory tusk, all the dogs were like, boom, this is really interesting. Not like indicating, but like really interesting. They don't want to go away. So I see that more with the hunting dogs. And that's also what I test when I'm doing scouting and selecting dogs for wildlife, for example. So I can lay down some ivory, or I can say lay down some turtle shield. Some dogs will not give a reaction on that, but some dogs are like really like, boom, I don't want to go away from that. And I say, okay, this is the type of dog I like to train for conservation, for wildlife trafficking. So. Yeah, I'll also look into that.
Mm. And do you, in your training program, do you align to any particular third-party certification program, or do your clients ask for that, or do you just have your own internal standards?
I have my own standards, but to be honest, in a lot of countries where I build up really units, they don't know anything about dogs. Yeah. So, sometimes I go there and my job is to train like the dog handlers, and I see like customs or police, they're doing like a vertical checkpoint just by hand, and I'm looking like they need some training for this as well. So it's like really creating a specialized job, a team that can do search without dog, with dog. It's like everything, but also like some standards what in Africa, for example, they have. They are like, with all respect, they have some standard, but that's already what I train, like with distraction odors, with everything. So I hope also in Africa and other countries that there will be like some certification standards. Some projects what I'm doing, they let an auditor is coming, so another dog trainer, they will do a certification, so that works always perfect. I have my own standards, but I've seen some other countries or some projects that get a lot of money, and I come there and the dogs are looking like if they're falling asleep when they're going to work, because they have no training aids at work, they never hide something at a working area. So I hope in the future, that will be more the topic. There will be like a government standards.
Mm. It's very, very hard though, isn't it? We've talked about this with a range of guests on this show, and the standards, you know, almost vary project by project, really. You know, so trying to come up with a prescribed set of things that everyone buys into. And then a lot of people are very keen on, you know, conservation dogs having a lot of standard obedience behaviors built in as well. A lot of people are very averse to that too, you know, because you're trying to act, you know, you're trying to maintain that natural hunting drive as much as possible and their independence. I mean, what do you think about that? I mean, when you're training a dog for, just general conservation dog for a project, do you build in a lot of obedience behaviors or not, or which ones?
To be honest, with wildlife trafficking, I do not obedience, for example, just search, and I need to sit, and search is the most important.
Yeah.
With outside conservation, for me, I like if I see a team that can scent the dog from right side, left side, I really love that. But to be honest, In the first 2 years, I did it with my dog, like blind. I can send them like straight, left, everything, like remote control. Mm-hmm. Now I'm too busy. I say also honest. But I, when I need to train a conservation dog that search outside, I also scout a specific dog. So I will, I have a Labrador, a Springer Spaniel, and it sounds like crazy maybe. I can send them off leash. If an other animal is running out at front of him and he just take it off, those two conservation dogs will never go hunt because they are not interested in that. Mm. If I take some of my wildlife trafficking dogs and I said deploy them in that type of environment and they see a rabbit chase away or there, they will go after it 100%. But the job of the specialized job what I need outside off leash, I wanted the dog search, I whistle, they need to come, and I just send them, but not that well obedient. Mm. If I have a dog that don't have to focus or control, like a terrier, I will never do off leash, for example. So that is more the operational strategy, how I work. Mm. So if I do a conservation job, or any type of job, I have always two type of dogs in my car. Sometimes if they give me like a contract for a lot of working hours, I have three dogs in my car. One is like, for example, really systematic, really can work out different settings. One dog that can search on the boat, on the cano, really good to steady. And one dog that maybe takes a lot of speed, horsepower. So I like to have like different type of dogs. I'm not in a position that I only have one dog. And I need to work with that one. Mm. Because when I'm starting as a detection dog handler, I get one dog and you need to work the whole day. And that part is really hard, that you need to go out to the client, that you need to work so many hours. So I always say with my company, if we have a project, we not talk about one dog, but we always talk about two dogs and we look at your specific dog. And yeah, you know what I mean?
I do. And I think that's great. It also, though, leads into some challenges, which we can talk about now. So, you know, if you're not building automatons, like you were saying, so, you know, obviously each dog is unique and you've shaped them a different way and so on. So in the training shed, you've got this dog, you know, and it's good and it's ready to be deployed, but it's got its own unique characteristics and management requirements. And then you're going to go out to Malaysia, for example, and try and pair it up with a handler. What is that process like for you? So how do you go through that process of, I mean, do you get to choose the handler, or is the handler given to you? And then how do you train them?
Well, I always say, when we're starting a project, I always say, okay, listen, we're going to do two handlers or one dog. And a lot of people will say, Wesley, no, you don't need to do that. I say, listen, this is another world. We go to a different country. What if I train one handler and that one handler gets sick or stop with his work? All the specialized training what I and my team are doing for maybe 1 or 2 years is gone. A lot of money is gone. So we're starting with two handlers. Then if I have a group of handlers, I know the behavior of my own dogs, of course. So I see, okay, this guy is like really, really high energy. I give him a calm dog. If I got like, fast dog, slow people. So that's a little bit how I make the combination. And then they need to do one job at a time. So I mean, one handler is really good with handling and one guy is really good with clickering and understanding the training part more about when do I need to hide the odor or how I need to hide the odor or in operational settings. So then I starting to train one thing at one time. And in the beginning, I always say to people, listen, in the beginning, I was looking who's the best natural handler the guy that's picking up fast, don't understand me wrong, the secondary handler, I will give you later a lot of training, but now I need to focus on operational training. So that system works really good, because when I'm gone, you see the handlers going to train that, and also the secondary handler. You will see later they train themselves, and that system works really good.
Yeah, it sounds like a great way of doing it, really. You're building in that sort of peer review process as you go through, and making sure that you've trained people, you know, to make each other better, I guess, for the team.
So yeah, it's a teamwork, and they need to do exercise with Doc, of course, but also without Doc, and you see it's really helping. So every course we focus on this exercise, and we train it to make it perfect. And what I've seen is, like, especially like I can make it so difficult in behavior language, they will never understand, to be honest. So I hold it really easy that they understand it. And then you see step by step, they train that. Another course we come, we repeat a little bit what we did the last time. And you see, oh, that works really well. Or, oh, with this team, we need to train this a little bit more. And then we go to the next step. And that is how you need to work with a team or in a country where they don't have the culture to be raised up with a dog or to have a dog at home. Yeah, there's a different world. And you see that really.
Mm. So how long does that process take? So you go out, you do a course with a new handler team. How long is that course? And then do you go back and do regular follow-ups, or is that kind of done?
Now I say to, for example, if they're starting a project, I say, listen, it cost me like 1 year, 1.5 year to make a really good team. So if you don't have the training money, it's not going to work. Mm-hmm. So sometimes they call, I say, Wesley, I want 10 dogs. And I say, no, I give you 5 dogs, but spend the other money for training. And that's going how it works better. And there's a different, I need to say, if I go to Europe or to another country where they grow up with dogs, you can do it in a couple of weeks and a refresh course, of course. But if you go to countries where they don't have that, yeah, in the beginning, it's difficult for some person to give love to a dog, for example. Mm. Because it's a different culture in Africa, for example. But you will see slowly when they see the dog and the bond between, you will see that that will change. But that make it difficult and really long and intense. But yeah. They need to give me that time. Otherwise, it's not possible. Otherwise, I say also no, because otherwise the dog will fall down.
No, that's good. So let's move on to projects now. What projects have you guys been, or your dogs been involved in? You know, whereabouts in the world are you working? What have you been looking for? What have been the greatest successes?
Now, for example, we also work like in the Netherlands, for example, to do like invasive species, like also plants, but also to locate some specific animals. So we do also that. And for me, that was like a fascinating world, especially like underwater, under the ground detection. I know some training from HRD, so I take that little bit of experience. But when are we going in the field? Yeah, I learned so much more from that type. And I think in your country is that way more involved than Europe, and because you need it more there, or you take it there more serious than here. The Dutch government, for example, you see it's coming, mm-hmm. but yeah, I think we are way behind you over there. We have so many projects. I don't know, Indonesia is, for example, the biggest. So at this time is like one instructor is there, I think for 8 weeks to deliver 2 new dogs that we train here like for, I think, a year because COVID was in the way. And she's now there here. And then we give the dogs like, for example, like 5 weeks off. They need to bond with the handlers. They do the practical basic exercise, what we learn. And then another instructor is flying there to refresh the training and to go to the next step. And I'm just back from a special mission with my colleague that we fly in with our own dogs to assist the law enforcement for special wildlife operations. And to be honest, I work now 15 years in operational settings, but this operational settings were like amazing. Normal, they give you the airport or the seaports, and sometimes you do roadblocks, but everything what I want or everything what we want to do, we can do it there. So yeah, really interesting and also fascinating to see, because if you searching on a border cross and you see the dogs are like on the floor with the nose, and in the beginning they're like really strange behavior, and we think, what's this? And we think, oh, maybe they're street dogs, so they need to adapt to the environment. And then you're standing there on the roadblock side, and then you're seeing some cars that coming. You see they're more heavy on the back, and you talk with the border forces guys, and I say, listen, if there's wildlife trafficking, the blood or the water or the ice, just say something, will go drop from the car on the ground. And then I look at my colleague, and we think, oh yeah. That's why in the beginning, the dog were like over full. If you come with a dog in a slaughterhouse, they were like so different behavior. Yeah. So that is like interesting to see, but also that the dogs give them a couple of minutes and then they boom, they go to work. But that's like interesting facts to see. All the kind of odors.
It's interesting. I mean, on that project that you've recently been on, I mean, so you've gone over with your dogs, you know, for operational deployment. How long does it take? You know, so you've got established dogs, they know the job, they know everything they're doing, they're paired with you, so, you know, there's no issues with the team. How long does it take them to become acclimatized to a different, you know, different country, different situation before you feel they're back to 100%?
Yeah, it depends also a little bit about the operational level of the dogs. To be honest, there was one dog that have like really operational background for 6 years. So we know this dog have also been on the plane before. He's ready for this. So we know 100% this dog will go. Yeah, we really take him out of the of the kennel. He was like there for, I think, 15 hours on the plane trip. And we take him out. And the first time what he see was a car and he was starting to search. So we know that dog was doing okay. And I take one younger dog also with me, that been in training and operational in the Netherlands, but not like overseas or that type of environment. So with that dog, you see it cost like 2 days when he got to the climate. We give him 2 days off, but we also look at we don't starting to search in when it was too hot during the day. So for example, from 2 o'clock to 4 o'clock, you don't go out. We take the safety rules really seriously, of course. But for me, it's really interesting to see how fast the dog will adapt to the climate. Because when I sent the dog to Africa to track down poachers, that's also specialized training. Because when I'm gone, I say to the handlers, start walking a little bit or start running a little bit with the dog and also a little bit in the sun. And when I'm coming back for refresh course and we do a track, a really long track, at the end of the track, I'm like, and I say, oh, the dog need to lay down in this and relax. And the rangers start laughing and say, Wesley, he can track the whole day like this. And I'm really like, whoa, amazing. So yeah, it's also fascinating to see how fast the dogs adapt to the climate, and you can really train them to search in that type of weather, in the hot climate. You really can train that. And it's for me still interesting to see.
Mm. And I mean, a lot we've talked about, you guys do a lot of different stuff. Which projects do you enjoy the most personally, or what do you find you get the most kind of value out of, you know, emotionally, if you see what I mean? What projects do you get the most pride out of? Which ones do you feel you're doing the most good work in?
Now, for me, the wildlife trafficking. So yeah. I train a lot of customs dog for narcotics. Of course, I like when they found a lot of cocaine. But when you searching for the first time and the dog's indicating and we're just looking and you see like four primates are like in a small box, two are already dead. They are like 18 hours under the bus trip from 18 hours. The mothers get murdered. So that, yeah, if you see that, yeah, you start crying like, what's this? Why the world is like so sick? So it's for me also like the conservation job, especially wildlife trafficking. It's I don't do it as a business. So I make it a business in a company, but also during COVID, it was a difficult time. I donate two dogs to a unit. I provide one specific training course, non-profit. So we also do that type of job because we like to help also small projects. So they're also like big project. They have a lot of money to do everything perfect. Of course, that's how I want to do it. But I also go sometimes when I get a phone call and I hear like, oh, there's a park. They don't have like any dog food. I call my sponsor and they fly in the dog food, for example. And I go in by myself to train the handlers there. Because what I like also about to train those rangers, some of them are never been in the position to go to school or to study. So normally nobody sees them. So when you go to train a specialized team, and after 1.5 year, you see them when there's like a special search operation, they're like police, wildlife crime task force, there's everybody there in the room. They can also sit at the table and they ask their advice because they need to say how they're going to search. So when you see when they're so proud and people see them, that's for me also like amazing because that gives me a lot. Mm. It's not only the dog; it's also if you train those people, it's like mind blowing. I love that.
Yeah, I can see how that would be. that would be absolutely awesome. Really, very rewarding. What's your favorite country to work in, and why?
I cannot say. No. I'm like a canine operator. I like to travel to the jungle, tropical jungle. But then I like to go back to search today, full in the rain, with the other specific disciplined dogs outside, and then I like to go to Africa to track down Africa because it's also like this. If you, for example, do tracking with the tracking dogs in Africa, it's completely different operational settings than tracking dogs in Malaysia or the tropical bush. So in Africa, you want everything fast. You run into the poacher. In Malaysia, it can be dangerous, for example. So there I need to, we train the tracking dog to locate the human activity. You become close. They will indicate. We say, stop team. And the rangers go really on hand and foot. You don't hear them. And they go to see if there's a poacher camp. If there's a poacher camp, they call backup. And it can cost maybe 2 days or a week when the backup is coming. So for me, it's the different operational environments, different operational strategies. That's for me the most interesting. And that challenges me all the time. So I cannot say I like Africa. And not Indonesia. I like both. I like everything. So, yeah. Sorry, I cannot give.
No.
That's like what I like about that.
No, it's interesting, but it also raises a question that I've been, becoming more aware of the older I get, is that I spend an awful lot of time conditioning my dogs and making sure they're ready for a particular, for a particular project. And then you get out in the field and you're handling them, and the older you get, the more it hurts. Yeah. And the more tired you get, you know, when you're clambering around and that kind of thing. So with your busy life, as we know you have, you know, how do you keep yourself operationally ready?
Now, to be honest, before I was like really like a sportman. I was running all every time in the gym. You say it correct when you have your own business. Yeah, I spend more time on training than training myself. But now, especially if I will go to Africa or to a tracking dog unit, I will start training before, because I know I will not survive in that climate. I cannot speed up with them. But now what I've seen also that my, because I walk all the day with the dogs, search outside with the dogs. Yeah. We also on a good condition because we are so much outside. But I understand what you're saying, that if you search in the water, you need to go to the mud. I 100% what you're saying, but I think yes, sport is the exercise. But especially for the jungle or for Africa, I really train for it. Yes,
yeah, and I think that's right. It's just interesting. I mean, I train a lot of newcomers to the industry, and when we're out in deployment or I'm working with them, they're generally pretty young, and that's great. There's young newcomers to the industry, and I used to always be out in front, and now I'm starting to find myself falling behind a bit. It's you're just trying to work out it makes you up your game a bit.
But for you, you're still like active like a lot in the field, or are you what you say you it changes also a lot
of- a bit of a combination, really. So for me personally, I'm still active in the field, but I'm starting to emphasize more training the next generation to come through, really, and trying to pass on that knowledge a bit more, and trying to focus on that.
That's also important, but also I think when you do the operational, you still have that fire, right? What I mean?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
I don't want to give up the operational.
that is what I like, because I see some really good operators, then they're becoming instructors more and only instruct, and they're not handling any dog anymore. And then I see something when they're handling a dog and it's take a light, you see that the skill set is going a little bit lost. Of course, they know it in their mind, but being in the field and still training the dogs, that gives the fire to us, I think.
It does. Wesley Fisher, look, thank you very much for taking the time to chat. It's been great catching up with you. So if people are interested in learning more, following the work of your team, how should they best do that?
Now, the best thing is what I say, Centric Brand Conservation Dogs on Instagram or Facebook. Yeah, then you see more the projects, what we are doing. We always try to give a little bit updates also about the training. They can follow us over there. And thank you for this chat.
No, it's been great, and I'll let you get to bed now. Thanks, mate.
Thank you. Have a nice day over there. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the Conservation Canine Podcast. If you've enjoyed the show, please like, share, and subscribe wherever you find us.